struggling with the word of God. A hand in my Bible, a hand on my knob, a glimpse of heaven on the way to hell.
Hey everyone, it's Eric, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of Dialogue Tree, the show formerly known as Second Quest. My guest today is Stephen Totillo. Stephen is a well-known journalist and writer who has worked for outlets such as the New York Times and MTV News, among others, before joining the video game site Kotaku in 2009. In January 2012, Stephen was named Kotaku's editor-in-chief. He joins me to discuss the changes he's made to Kotaku since then and his vision for the site. Stephen Totillo, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, you became Kotaku's editor-in-chief 3 months ago, and you've made several adjustments to the structure and focus of the site. Are you trying to make it into something different or clarify what Kotaku already was?
Yes to both. Let's take the second one first. So I think that Kotaku has had some great strengths that are worth continuing. Kotaku has often been known as the place to have information first, to have it fastest, which is sort of the same thing, and to give you a lot of the gaming news that you need. Now, I know that there's other outlets that you can go to, but I'm still quite proud of the fact that under Brian Crescente and under Joel Johnson and now under myself, we've broken many stories, and that's something that we want to continue to do. But I think that one thing that people didn't completely get about Kotaku that I felt a need to clarify was how it's not a monolithic entity, and it isn't really about having a single voice. It's about having multiple voices that might not always agree, that need to operate with certain shared values, but that we can have different areas of focus, different ways that we express ourselves. And so one of the changes that you're probably referring to is what we called the Kotaku Programming Network, which was an attempt to express more clearly to our readers that we think of ourselves, I certainly think of ourselves, a little closer to what you would expect from a television network, in that you wouldn't expect the cartoons and the nightly news and the dramas and the daytime talk shows to all have the same voice or necessarily all cover the same things. And while we are still at our core about gaming and gamers culture, I wanted it to be more clear that we're a bunch of different people. And so that overnight, that's something a little bit different. That's Kotaku East. That's something that's much more Asia-centric, and we actually amplified that by bringing in writers in Tokyo and in Beijing and in Seoul to work in addition to Brian Ashcraft, who's in Osaka, and to make that more clear that is more of Brian Ashcraft's vision and that it is about not just gaming culture but pop culture in Asia. And I'm happy to be able to offer readers voices from all those different places. And that's different than doing a comedy section, which we now do. And we have kind of this rant section that we run every Friday, where we have Kirk Hamilton, who's great about writing about video game music. And I wanted to showcase his expertise and excellence at that. And if he had more to say than just to do a weekly column. So we give him 2 hours every Thursday afternoon to curate what I think winds up being the best micro blog for video game music that you can find anywhere. So we wanted to give people more of a sense of different voices are here at Kotaku. That's something that we are proud of. So that was a long answer to half of the question. Remind me what the other half of the question was.
Well, actually, talk a little bit more about the programming blocks, because I think that was something that was probably most confusing to readers of Kotaku and non-readers of Kotaku. So
yeah, a lot of people thought it was pretty stupid.
Yeah, yeah. Now, if I'm hearing you correctly, you know, sort of the idea of the editor-in-chief, you know, you have a vision for the site, but what I'm hearing from you is you want to kind of bring a more democratic or egalitarian sort of approach to the site and allow different things to germinate and to come out and, you know, have an idea of Kotaku not as a publication per se, but more of a collection of voices. Is that right?
Yes, and I wouldn't say that there was a lack of different voices beforehand, but I would say that we didn't do the best job that we could to explain that to our readers. So a lot of readers rightly questioned, how is this on the site? Or why is this on the site? Or why do you have this story that doesn't seem to have a connection to video games implied, as I understand video game news to be, on this site? And I view all criticism, regardless of whether it has rancor in it or not, as containing some validity. Some criticism is perfect and spot on. We've done something wrong. We need to fix it. And so when you have enough people saying in comments or emails or tweets or what have you that what is with Kotaku, or they're schizophrenic, or they're doing all these different, you know, they don't seem to understand what their own site is supposed to be about. I thought, well, no, then it's our obligation to make it more clear what we believe belongs on Kotaku, and we should do a clearer job of that and recognize that we must not be doing something right. So I think, you know, if for those who still hang around and ask why do you have this story or that story, at this point I think it's closer to, it can now be a little more valid for me to say, well, then you just must not be paying attention to what we do. But I think more and more people get it and they understand. There was a lot of criticism of the programming blocks in the sense that people thought, and they took this metaphor that was an admittedly flawed metaphor, they took it to think that that would mean that you would actually have to be on Kotaku during certain hours in order to get certain content, and then it would disappear when you went away. But I said no, it's an infinite DVR. We're online, right? Any piece of content we put up at any point is still going to be searchable later. When I announced the programming blocks, which was on a Friday, the programming blocks hadn't started yet. They didn't start till a Sunday night. So in the abstract, without having any example to look at, I think people were freaked out that, oh, this is going to be this weird site that's all scheduled, and I'm going to have to, they're going to expect me to show up at 5 p.m. for this and 3 p.m. for my Nintendo news and, you know, whatever they might have thought, which I can understand where they thought that. And then sure enough, within a few days, people saw how it worked and there wasn't much consternation as far as I could tell.
Was it a misunderstanding that Kotaku was a video game site, do you think?
No, it was a misunderstanding that the only things we would ever do would be to write about video game product or to interview video game developers. And it was a misunderstanding that we would find crimes related to video games interesting, or that we might even find a cool sci-fi movie or some interesting sneakers or toys or something interesting. And we have said that while some of that may not even technically involve a video game, we think that we have, and we can see this in our readership and how readers react to stories through the stats that are transparent and you can see them on the site, that there's an interest there that people who love video games, which is an incredibly diverse amount of people, I mean, it's my mother, it's me, it's my brother who plays one game a year, you know, it's so many different people. So really, in a way, we have a license to write about anything, but we know that would be absurd and extreme. So instead we say, no, look, at our core, we're going to write about video games, but we're going to write about what we think is interesting when it comes to video games. And we're not going to be just a trade publication. And if you want just the news of which games are coming out and reviews and interviews with the developers, you can either take the Kotaku core slice of Kotaku that we've offered, or there's other sites that may be you know, more your speed. But no, we are a video game news and opinion site first and foremost, but we extend beyond to what we believe is the culture of video games and the way that games intersect with the broader culture.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because Kotaku historically has always published non-video game related materials. And, you know, one of the things about those posts or those articles, I think a lot of people criticized them more for the fact that they didn't seem to be as perhaps focused or as well structured as the non-video game related material. Then I also think there were people that were just upset that Kotaku was not staying the same and was not staying into their idea of what the site should be, which you know, unless you're working for the site, is sort of an odd thing to say, I think. Could you talk a little bit about that, about the criticism and how that affects, you know, what you do and kind of the decisions that you've made since you've become editor-in-chief, or does it affect it?
Well, we don't hear from most of the people who read the site. We have, our numbers are on the site. You can go, you can find the traffic. You can go to a site called Quantcast. Go to quantcast.kotaku.com. You'll see the numbers. We don't hide them. They're available. They're visible from going to various stats pages. And you can see, we have 2.5 million people reading the site. Every month, 2.5 million uniques in the United States. If you expand it out to internationally, worldwide, closer to 5 million people. And we don't hear from 5 million people. So we do think, on the one hand, well, we don't know what most people think of us. You got to go by what you hear or what your gut tells you, and also how things perform. And so you can't ever get too hung up on any one piece of criticism, but you need to pay attention to all of it. And when it rings true and you react to it. And as a deputy editor at the site for 2 years, I was able to do that, and as editor-in-chief, I can react more to that. But I, like I said to you before, I take every bit of criticism seriously, even when people are cursing at us and yelling at us. And we have a lot of people who give us courteous criticism. Sometimes it's like, you made a typo, you need to fix it. Well, of course, we'll fix the typo. And sometimes it's, you know, why is this story here? The complaint that there's non-video game stories, I tried to address with the Kotaku core and also with the programming blocks in order to first give people some tools so that they could more clearly see where some of the ostensibly non-video game stuff might run and also have ways to block it out if they didn't want that. But yeah, just to wrap this up for a sec, but the other thing there is that we publish many stories. We publish 40 or 50 stories a day, and when I look at our stack of stories, I see more than enough to interest even the person who doesn't want to click on a story that they might be complaining about. So, I mean, there still might be something wrong with that story, but I don't think we're lacking for giving people alternatives and giving people probably something a little closer to what they want. It's all there.
Yeah, and the same people that were criticizing Kotaku for publishing non-video game related content, I think were also a lot of the same people that criticized your announcement of Kotaku Core. So what do you make of that?
I don't know. I don't know that they were the same people. I know that some people didn't like Kotaku Core because they felt it was an abandonment of the mission of Kotaku. Others just didn't like the way it functioned technically.
Right. Well, I know for a fact. I mean, example. I don't generally like to bring him up, but for example, someone like and his name is escaping me at the moment, who ran Video Game Journalists or Incompetent Fuckwits, Ben Patton. Right. You know, he was one of the most, I think probably the most well-known or vocal critic of video game sites, and, you know, whatever your opinions of his work are not, he also, like, explicitly criticized Kotaku Core. So, you know, if you can take him as the mouthpiece of a certain audience that's out there.
It's hard for me to do that because he criticized just about everything we ever did that I ever saw on his site. But put it in your own words though. And elaborate, because I mean, like I said, I wanted to give people a slice of Kotaku to a lot of people who I just could have easily been like, ah, screw you, go away. But no, well, why would I do that? There are people who want our pure video game news, and I wanted to give them that opportunity within the tech, within the parameters of the tech that I am able to operate in. I work at a larger company, Gawker Media, not that much larger. The head of the company sits 20 feet away from me, but I can't redesign the site on my own. What I can do is work within the structures that are available. So would I like to be able to make it, you know, super easy for you to filter out certain things? Sure, but what I can do is really only give you a binary decision one way or the other, which is you can look at stories that are tagged with a specific tag, or you can look at everything. So you can go to kotaku.com/PS3, and you'll only get the stuff we run PS3. So I'm like, you know what? Let me try to figure out a way to slice the site, or at least to provide a filter that I think can make the people who just want the pure gaming news happy. Because I want to make those people happy. I don't want those people to be bummed out by stories they don't like. And I can't stop having us run those stories because there's plenty of people who like reading those stories and click on those stories. So how can I make those people happy? How can I make Ben Patton happy? I guess that's what I was trying to do, right? And so the Kotaku Core slice, and those who've paid closer attention to Kotaku Core may have noticed that it went from not really having any developer interviews worked into it at all. It was really very much about product, and we've broadened it out to try to include more stuff. But we're always going to be struggling right, you know, there with where we draw that line of what we put as Kotaku Core or not. But you know, Kotaku Core wasn't me saying I'm embarrassed of other content. It was me saying I recognize that there are people who only want this aspect of what we do, and I would like to provide it to them. And I don't think that's different than being the editor of a newspaper who knows that some people only want to read the business section, or being the head of HBO and knowing people want to subscribe for Game of Thrones but really could care less about the boxing, or couldn't care less about the boxing that's airing, you know, the night before or something like that. I want to be able to please the people who are in some ways motivated to care about our content.
Yeah, talk a little bit about some of the editorial changes that you've made and Kotaku has made since you become editor-in-chief. You know, for example, one of the big changes that was made early on that you announced was a change in the review policy. So, you know, before I don't think it's unfair to say that Kotaku wasn't known for reviews. I mean, they did publish them and people obviously did read them. But you
we were known for changing our review format all the time.
Yeah, right.
So we were known for, to those who paid any attention, it seemed like every 6 months we had a new review style of doing reviews. So I had to change it again, the tradition of the site.
Well, I think it's an interesting change. So basically the idea behind the reviews, well, I don't want to speak for you, but this is the summation that I got out of it, is you're sort of taking a more personal approach and you're allowing your reviewers to for dictate the format themselves, and also at the same time you are kind of placing a standardized not a reviewing format on it, but a, you know, sort of a yes, buy this game, no, this game is not recommended or not yet sort of thing, which I think is interesting. So talk about those two parts of it, and, you know, how you see those working with each other.
Sure. And what you said was mostly spot on, but there's a couple of key distinctions that I'll point out as well. So the writers, and this is consistent with what I was saying before, that I'm interested in elevating the variety of voices that we have on the site. We have a lot of really talented writers, a lot of really good reporters, and I felt that I want people to know their names if readers are such that they care about names and bylines. Many readers don't. Most readers don't. But to those who would ever follow a particular critic or journalist, I want them to recognize that there are some real great talents here at Kotaku. So I wanted the writers to feel free to express themselves about a video game in any way that they wish to, and so that if they wish to review a game through writing a poem about it or drawing a picture about it or whatever. Owen Good reviewed a game. I think it was the Neverdead game. He reviewed it through the tweets that he fired off while playing it to great frustration. Others have just written a straight sort of essay-type review. Others have done more bullet-pointy type things. But I wanted to give them free rein there because I felt there's so many different types of games. I mean, it's not really that necessary to me to standardize a review format for the way you're going to write about it if the game is a yearly iteration, a sports game or whatever. But then what I wanted to do was make sure that for those who were in a hurry, who just want some basic information, can you just tell me if the game's any good? We wanted to give people that as succinctly as possible. As you can tell from this, by the way, I have trouble being succinct, so this was hard for me. And so we came up with a simple question. Should you play this game? This is an evolution, a wonderful evolution of the notorious gut checks that we did last fall that people had a lot of trouble with, in which case we were saying, should you buy this game? And a lot of people had problems with us giving that as a straight-up consumer advice because we don't know how much money people have or if the game's going to drop in price and all that kind of thing. And this is, should you play this game? And it's like I said when I introduced this, I think that most of the time we're going to be saying yes or we're going to be saying not yet, which is this weird new category that we have, right? People have typically assessed games and they've had to apply a score, and it's some numerical version of yes and no and, you know, various grunts in between, because that's what a 0 to 10 or a 0 to 100 scale would be. But not yet is this weird thing. Not yet implies there's some sort of change that can occur to this video game. Its price might change or it might be patched or something like that. And that's something that reviews just aren't doing these days. Games continue to evolve after their release, but reviews stay static. The review of the game is only relevant, if that, to the day the game came out. And even then, it often doesn't encompass the multiplayer experience when played live with the public on servers and how the community that's playing the game affects the game. Doesn't address the patching of the game. It doesn't address all these other things that are important for anybody who's considering the game buying, you know, a week after it came out or something. So we allow for a not yet and an ability to update it. And the other part of that standardized thing where we put the answer to that question is we just have a few basic bullet points, a couple of highs, a couple of lows, some jokey back-of-the-box quotes that we, you know, sort of manufacture as kind of winks to what we really think about the game kind of thing, or right, what you would tweet about the game. And you could actually take that sidebar thing that I'm talking about, and you could look at just that, and I think you could get a sense of what we thought of the game. And so what we'll probably start doing in the future is just extracting that sidebar and sharing that around, maybe through Facebook or whatever, to give that, because I think for people who are in a rush, that's sort of our tweet of our review in a way, right? That's our shareable, hey, you just need to know a couple of things here. Just look at this part. And so it's severable, I think, from the more through-written review, which is for somebody who really wants to critique.
What do you think the purpose of video game reviews is on Kotaku and in general?
I think that most people are looking for them as shopping guides, and the sidebar thing that we do honors that request. But I think that reviews can and should also be a place for intelligent criticism, and that's what we are able to do in the other half. So we're trying to have it both ways.
Now, moving on to a separate issue, Kotaku, as you said, is one of the largest video game blogs out there. And
I don't like calling it a blog anymore.
Okay, well, what do you like to call it?
A website.
A website. Okay.
I mean, what's the difference between us and GameSpot or IGN in terms of, what you think of The Voice or something, or what content we might run on a given day might be different. But other than the fact that you can still look at a blog view of Kotaku where things are reverse chronological and we as the editors aren't telling you what the most important thing is because we're not putting that first, other than that, which isn't even the default view of the site, I don't see what's different between us and Rock Paper Shotgun or the Penny Arcade Report or IGN or any other outlet. So the blog term may have been relevant in the past, but it just doesn't make sense to me anymore.
Well, that's interesting. That gets into another issue, but one of the things that I interviewed Chris Grant a couple months ago, and one of the things that he said he was hoping to do with the Vox games had more to do with the technology, the publishing technology behind what they can bring to the table. And right now you're seeing a lot of gaming blogs, quote-unquote websites, whatever you want to call them, hitting the limitations of what they can do with that sort of publishing format. Where do you see that going? And I mean, can you envision sort of a completely different look for Kotaku, or a completely different sort of even organizational scheme, or have you been thinking about that?
I haven't been thinking about that all that much, because Chris at Vox is at a startup company. They can build their site up from scratch. I guess it could function like The Verge, but I'm pretty sure they've publicly said that if they were going to look like The Verge, then they would have just launched already. So they're able to structure something, and I think that they'll take lessons from a lot of the sites that are really media dense in terms of trailers and screenshots and what have you, and also, sort of just have something that feels very cutting edge in terms of the various technologies that they have going in it. We operate within, Kotaku does, within Gawker Media, which is also Gizmodo and Gawker and Deadspin and Jezebel and IO9 and Jalopnik and a couple other sites, Lifehacker. Oh, I'm not mentioning one. I feel terrible, but I don't remember which one. I'm omitting. And so the decisions for our technology are made by the tech department that looks over all those companies. So, for a lot of people, when they're thinking about what Kotaku is doing, about whether it's editorial or tech or whatever, bear in mind, I don't look that much at what Joystick is doing or IGN or whatever. I look at what Gawker and Jezebel and Deadspin are doing. We're all doing the same thing in terms of tech, but the successes that these other sites have had in our family of sites, the successes that they've had in terms of addressing, doing stories that are genuinely interesting, finding things that really tap into your sense of wonder or your sense of outrage, stories that you would tell somebody about even if you didn't think that they were that into the thing that you were ostensibly writing about all the time, stories that transcend whatever box you might draw yourself in as a reader or as a reporter, those are the stories that we're trying to do more and more of. And so I look at a lot of the successful stories and exciting stories and interesting stories among our peers, my peers here, and that's what I'm finding inspiration in. And really, frankly, just anything that I find to be interesting, regardless of whether it's being published on a gaming site or not. I'm not answering your tech question, but only because I don't have much to tell you on that. I don't think that much. I don't think too hard about the tech. A lot of what you saw already with Kotaku Core and the programming network, that's me operating within the opportunities and limitations of our current tech. And so I'm able to do some things like slice things off or program things a little bit. But, where we go technologically speaking, I'm sure will involve a way to elevate the visuals even more prominently than we have. It will still allow for good writing, but how posts will organize and whatever the next design is of sites, will change 10 times over before it's set in stone. So I don't really know where that'll go. And frankly, I'm not really sure what our readers are wanting there either. So I don't know.
Well, let's go back and talk about the editorial side a little bit. Kotaku is one of the biggest websites, video game websites out there. And it's highly scrutinized by minority and female gamers, as other video game sites are. But Kotaku is one of the most, I guess, prominent examples out there. What is your responsibility to those communities?
Our responsibility is to make everybody feel welcome when they read our site, and to not make them feel ostracized, and to not make it seem as if they don't count as gamers. We had a misstep with the Sonic the Hedgehog bed story that people like to mention to me all the time, which was a comedy piece that we ran on our comedy block. It was supposed to be for Valentine's Day, and then it fell through the cracks. We ran it a little bit later in the month. I think it would have hit a little better if it was closer to Valentine's Day. People would have gotten that it was tongue-in-cheek. But A, it wasn't funny enough, but B, and this was more important, the writer of it, and later acknowledged that this was a mistake on his part, but it was a bigger mistake on mine for not catching this when I was editing it. He addressed the readership as if they were all straight guys looking to sleep with girls, and it excluded, and that those were gamers, that that's what gamers were. And it struck the wrong note, because everybody on the site can have their own opinion and they can express what they want, but it's my responsibility to make sure that if you are a female reader of any orientation, or if you are a gay male reader, if you are whoever, and you're reading the site, you shouldn't be confronted with an article that acts as if you don't count as a gamer, that you're not part of the gaming population. That's wrong, and that was a mistake, and I apologized for it. Talked to the writer after the fact. I apologized to him for not catching that and saying, I have to tell something to my readership. I have to tell them that I messed up. And he said, no problem. If you want to update the story and sort of make it more inclusive, you go ahead. You can do that. So the story now includes a note of apology from me about that, because that was a mistake. Our job is to make sure that everybody feels included, which won't mean that everybody likes every story. And it will mean that some people will still get to a story and they'll say, oh my God, this is, you know, why are you showing scantily clad pictures of a woman here? Or why are you carrying on about how black characters are represented there? And, you know, there'll be people who will be annoyed about various things. So we're going to walk a line. Sometimes we'll make mistakes and sometimes we won't. But we're not going to deny that people find things attractive or titillating or sexy. But we're also not going to deny that there are readers of all types and they all deserve to have stories that treat them with intelligence and respect, and that those two things aren't mutually exclusive. There's plenty of people of all types who enjoy all types of content.
Yeah, the Sonic the Hedgehog bedsheets story was one of the stories published on Kotaku recently that did get a lot of criticism. And in the past, this is before you took the post of editor in chief, so you know I know you can't speak on this, but there was an article published called This Gamer's Story, which got a lot of feedback from a different type of audience than criticized the Sonic the Hedgehog bedsheet story.
Might have been the same audience. Why wouldn't it be the same audience? In fact, This Gamer's Story was about the experience of being gay and being called faggot and the hurt that word has, and that word is so loaded and horrifying that to use it casually is just this insult. In gaming is putrid and disgusting, and the very people who would read and appreciate that story, I think, are the people who might also notice that the Sonic bedsheet story was exclusionary.
No. I think, yeah, no, that's exactly what I was saying. I'm saying the people that criticize This Gamer's Story are not the same people that criticize the Sonic the Hedgehog bedsheet story.
I misunderstood it.
Yeah.
Apologies.
So does the internet and sort of the audience for gaming news and commentary in particular allow for mistakes and missteps? How do you account for the fact that, you know, you come on the scene, you've been in the job for 3 months, you're making strides to, I think, make Kotaku better. I think, you know, you're definitely on that path. And yet the criticism just seems to get more virulent, not less.
I haven't noticed it yet. How have you've seen it get more virulent? I haven't noticed.
Well, I just think it's, you know, I've only been paying attention to this stuff for a few years, but it just seems to me that people are so quick to jump on any perceived misstep or any perceived mistake and really just sort of assume the worst of the person making the mistake. you know, speak to that. I mean, obviously you may not feel that way, so that's fine. But what do you think about the criticisms and the of your mistakes that you get?
Well, it's an interesting question and a good one to ask about whether or not you can make a mistake, kind of get away with making a mistake, which is not how you phrased it, but for you, sort of like how mistakes live on the internet, right? And I think that, well, one of the trademarks of Gawker Media has been our transparency. The reason I was able to tell you before a URL where you could go to see the traffic of the site is because, unusual even for any media outlet, we don't hide our traffic. We let people know. You can see, and then you can judge for yourself. Oh my, they're doing that story because look at all the views it got. You can't even say that about any other outlet. I don't think any other gaming related outlet even publishes that. So you have no idea, you know, how stories perform elsewhere and what they're doing and what might drive them in terms of traffic. But part of the transparency is consistent with the way that Twitter operates and Facebook operates. And really it's consistent with the idea of having reader comments and being responsive to them. It's the transparency of like not settling for bullshit. It's the transparency of calling things out and being frank and being honest. And when you screw up, you admit you screw up, because it's just stupid to try to be too proud about a mistake. We write, and Ben Patton would back you up on this, we write far too many stories far too quickly for us to be able to ever claim that everything that we run is airtight in terms of the spelling or in terms of the grammar. You know, and he would catch us sometimes in embarrassing things where we would get the name of a game wrong or something like that. And I guarantee you that the things that when we're publishing that we think, oh, this is some important news that we're breaking, we're reading those stories over many, many, many times. And it would tend to be the things we did in a hurry, because we just wanted to tell people about a release date, or we wanted to tell people about whatever, and it's tied to a video game name. So you don't think about the game name as you're writing it or whatever, and that kind of thing slips through. But it's terrible, because you're putting a mistake on the site, and you know, the New York Times runs corrections, and we do too, so we fix them. So
Think that a pattern of little mistakes in say, grammar and getting certain facts wrong adds up to a sort of impatience for big mistakes?
It leads into a legitimate perception that the propensity for bigger mistakes might be there, but I know that I see the kind of corrections or changes we've had to run, and they're almost never been anything big. We don't get big facts wrong. We've gotten, like I said, the spelling of a game wrong, or yesterday I put the word me in a headline in two different spots, so it seemed like somebody said, "Does this talk like a pirate day?" Because the syntax was all off. You know, I'd gotten all the quotes in the story accurate. I listened to the quotes that I transcribe again and again to make sure I don't miss any piece of the quote. I got everything of that right, and of course the headline, which is the thing I put in there, and just pasted it in there and didn't read that over a second time. And then that was the thing, of course, where I had the mistake. So people look at misspellings and things like that, and they'll see it, and it's fun to laugh at that stuff, right? It makes you look silly. But, I'm not aware of us making mistakes regarding the news that we break or big, you know, big important stories. It tends to be people laugh at us because we get, we'll kind of stumble on some of the little things. But even there, you know, I think most people get it, or they understand. And they also, since I've been here, I've tried to slow things down a little bit and make sure we're better about that. But, you know, there's a reason that a lot of outlets have copy editors. Unfortunately, we don't have full-time copy editors, but readers are great about also pointing out a misspelling or something like that.
Why don't you have a full-time copy editor?
It's not something that we have. Most media organizations these days don't have full-time copy editors. It's just not budgeted into it. Kotaku specific, I couldn't justify in my budget having somebody copy editing full-time.
Do you think that's a problem?
In the perfect world, we'd all have copy editors on teams, but it's of the problems I have, I wouldn't say that is a huge problem, because there's ways to address it internally, having writers team up and copy edit each other's stuff, having sort of checks and some check and balances like that would certainly be useful.
Okay. Now, Kotaku is part of the video game journalism establishment, in as much as there is a video game journalism establishment. And you've been talking a lot about making sure that the voice of Kotaku doesn't assume that all of the readers are straight men or what have you. Do you think that Kotaku can ever be a force for change, or is that even something that a site like Kotaku should aspire to?
To be activist and change things? I mean, any good news outlet has influence and will cause things to change. We don't take up causes, and people were very mad at us because I decided that we weren't going dark during the SOPA protest because I didn't believe that it was the role of a news organization to go dark and not cover the news in an act of protest. In fact, I felt that it was our job to continue to cover news even during that, including cover SOPA and PIPA and the protests around it and keep people informed. So we probably do affect change. Sure we do. You know, we report layoffs at companies before people know about that, all around, and that helps people either get jobs or find out what their situation is. And we pan a game, and I'm sure that affects somebody's decision whether or not to buy the game. We try to make more voices present and let people feel more comfortable about who they are and who's gaming, and if that's having effects and making a few people be less obnoxious online or more welcoming to gamers of, you know, who might be different than them in some way, that would be great. I mean, I have a master's in journalism from Columbia, and when you go there, you get instilled with a sense of righteousness about the job of the journalist. It's the only career that has an exception carved out for it in the Constitution, the freedom of the press, right? And you are given this sense when you go to Columbia, or when you do a lot of things, are sort of like headier things in journalism, with the sense that you have this mission, you have this responsibility to expose the truth, to basically, you know, sort of challenge the powers that be and tell the people what they really need to know. And when you do that vis-a-vis politics or, you know, environmental, you know, the environment or something like that, it's obvious the nobility of that mission and the value of that mission. And it's harder to apply that to something when you're just covering entertainment, because a lot of times the readers just aren't interested in that. They just do want to know, like, what the cool new game is, and that's part of what you do. But always in the back of my mind, I remember my journalism school experience and that sense of mission and that hope that by always respecting the truth and the readers, that we will do the good thing that journalism is supposed to do in giving people information that they may not know existed, may not know they wanted to know, but we'll tell them.
What sort of reputation would you like to build for Kotaku? What would you like Kotaku to be known for?
I don't care that much that Kotaku is ultra widely known. I would be happy that people know great stories that we've done more so than that they know Kotaku. I won't lose sleep if people don't have the weird word Kotaku memorized, and if the average American doesn't know what it is, if they know the news that we've reported, and if they know, and if they've somehow bumped into the opinions that we've formed. I would like Kotaku to be known by those who do know that, do care what an outlet is called, as a cultural authority on video games that breaks news relevant to video games and the people who play them, and has smart opinions about the news around video games, and as well as smart opinions about the games themselves. You know, there's a lot of people doing good games journalism out there, and sometimes that gets lost because it's so much easier to criticize the stuff you don't like. It's human nature, right? And it's the things that are funnier to talk about is the stuff where people are screwing up. But there's a lot of good games journalism out there, and we have better and better tools for sort of sifting out the bad and following the good and encouraging the good. I take a lot of the criticism that I'll get or that I'll see come around as essentially encouragement to do better, and we can always do better. And in the process of all that, I hope that not only Kotaku has a bright future doing those things, but that other reporters and outlets do too.
Yeah, I think that on the whole, video game writing and video game journalism, I think, is getting stronger and not worse.
I don't think it's, at this point, I don't think it's any better or any worse than most other journalism. I think people have this notion that journalism in other fields is like so different. It's not that different, actually. It's like there's good journalists and bad journalists in all
fields. What do you account for that difference? I mean, why do you think people think that?
I think there's a bizarre obsession with video game journalism that it's remarkable. I really wish that when I looked at the people who follow me on Twitter, that every other person that I clicked on didn't in some way have in their bio that they were an aspiring game journalist. Because for me, my job is to reach more than just the people who would like to work for me or with me. And I think that I just would love, you know, I would love for people to just talk to, want to talk to me more about the news of games rather than the non-news of games journalism, which I think for them very often is what people are talking about. I mean, Lee Alexander has talked about it, I think, in a column that we wrote, that she feels weird about the fact that people think that she's a star. They ask her for an autograph. She's the reporter. She's impressed by the people that she reports on, and she wishes and that they were the people being asked for autographs. It feels weird for people to care about games journalism as much as they do. And I think some of that is fueled by this sense that game journalism is just this so much more broken element aspect of journalism than all other forms, but it's not. There are lazy journalists in every field. It is normal in many forms of entertainment journalism for there to be issues of people getting stuff for free and whether they take the stuff for free or not. When you cover the White House, you sit in a room and you have somebody brief you and they tell you what's on the record and what's on background and how you refer to people. It's not like covering a presidential press conference is that much different than covering an E3 press conference. I mean, you can burn shoe leather and do good reporting in any field. It's really the only thing that's different is how many lives you're affecting or whether you're actually affecting life. And, you know, video games, for most of the time, you're not.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining me and best of luck with the site.
And Eric, thank you. And I want to say thank you. I was wary before we talked that you were going to only mention stories you didn't like. You mentioned a story you liked. You mentioned this gamer's story. You liked that story, and I commend you for bringing in some of the positive and not just going on about stories that you didn't like, which is great. And I'm hoping that we can do a better job of showcasing our best work because it's so easy to find the stuff that's kind of missed the mark. And I hope that more and more people will develop an appetite for talking about the stuff that they like, and they share that around, they spread that around. We're trying to do a better job every Saturday with a roundup of what we think are our best stories. So I hope people will judge us on that as well and hopefully come away with a good opinion.
That's not the way to think. I want to let it shine.